Another year over, Rudolph. Another year of delivering presents. I tell you, just one year, just one year, I'd like to shoot someone. Just shoot someone right in the genitals.
What, the fat bus?
Walter Cronkite's wobbly helmet, Rudolph. You can talk?
Santa, I don't know if you've noticed, but I can fucking fly. And my nose is such an improbably shiny shade of red that it helps you see through fog on our way around the world in just one mystical night. But no, you're right. Me talking, that's a bit of a stretch.
Point taken, Rudy. Keep your antlers on.
And don't call me fucking Rudy. You don't hear me calling you Sans, do you? Or Fatso.
Okay, well, touchy for a magical reindeer, aren't you?
Sorry, boss, but can we go back to the part where you want to shoot someone in the junk?
Well, now, hear me out. For 1,500 years, Rudolph, long before you ever came on the scene, I've basically been a symbol of goodness, kindness, piety, generosity, and benevolence. Every year I have delivered presents to middle, upper middle, and upper class kids, mostly white, the world over. And even the poor kids get to learn the heartwarming message that it's not what you get for Christmas, but who you have in your life at Christmas that's important, even if it's an abusive, drug-addled uncle. Or they get to meet Bono and Lenny Henry. So basically, everybody wins. All that goodness can take a toll on a man, and your dreams can turn to an admittedly occasional dark place, like harming one of these selfish human bastards. One year, back in 906 AD, I accidentally bumped a child's face with my knee and experienced such an unparalleled sense of euphoria, I damn near soiled my suit. Then this other time, in 1932, I dreamed of breaking a hooker's neck in Detroit. Instead, I just snuck out without paying, but even that was enough joy to fuel me way into the mid-60s. But since around May of 1967, I've just had the strongest urge to shoot someone in the crotch. And no matter how many times I kick one of my dungeon elves or masturbate, the feeling is not going away. I mean, when you weigh up all the good I have done in the world, huh?
Sorry, boss, but dungeon elves?
Yes, some of my elves make toys, some do my taxes, and some, the uglier ones, mind you, they live in my dungeon and occasionally let me do things to them.
I don't think I want to go too much further down that line of questioning, do I, boss?
Not unless you like German pornography, Rudolph, no.
I still can't believe Santa, the old man who every child looks up to, the icon of giving, the beacon of goodwill, wants to shoot a human being in the bathing suit area. It just doesn't seem right.
It wouldn't have to be a nice one. It could be a real shitbag, like someone from the production team behind The Bachelor in Paradise, or someone who uses their car horn in the mistaken and arrogant assumption it will somehow make traffic vanish.
Even so.
Plus, think about it, it's the perfect crime. Not only am I a highly experienced breaker and enterer, but also 75% of the world population doesn't even believe I exist. And those who do are children who everyone assumes are lying anyway, or the insane, and they eat wallpaper, then watch those programs on daytime television where sarcastic judges, tired with doing any real legal work, insult stupid fat people and the poor. I mean, I could easily shoot one or three people in the frontal region, and they'd probably just file it under unsolved mystery or accuse a black teenager of doing it. Either way, I'm off scot-free.
Well, I want no part in it, sir. None at all. And if you plan on doing this one year on Christmas Eve, then you better hope no fog rolls in, because I'll be staying at home.
I thought you'd say that, Rudolph. That's why I intend to take that sneaky shit Prancer and blitz him, because I have something on him and he wants me not to tell anyone. I can bribe his lazy ass to take me down to Des Moines or somewhere and get the deed done.
Santa, you do what you want. I'm just a mere reindeer. Sure, I can fly insane speeds, my nose glows, and I can talk in full sentences, but at the end of the day, it's not like I could stop you. However, and I never thought I'd even ever say this, but Santa, You've really bloody disappointed me.
Well, I'm sorry you feel that way, Rudolph. I'm glad you felt safe voicing that opinion to me. I promise not to have it go against you when I'm choosing which one of you gets sent to the glue factory in spring. After all, that Cupid is a right cunt.
Oh, well, that was weird. I'm not sure what frequency we were picking up there. Kenneth, look into that for me, will you?
Oh, most definitely, Captain.
Sorry about that. Now, on Radio Flange Goblet, it's the After Movie Diner, which this week comes from Jaime's Limey Rhymey Time Climbing Restaurant and Grill, situated in Minneapolis. Stop that, will you? Goodness me. Cue the theme music.
You're listening to the After Movie Diner with your host, John Cross.
Hello, and you're listening to the After Movie Diner, and we're back after an extended period of busyness in my life with a fantastic, jam-packed Christmas episode that doesn't cover anything Christmassy whatsoever. But it is very exciting because we have an all-new guest on the show. Never spoken to this gentleman before outside of Twitter. He is Alex from the Boondoggle podcast, and I'm going to let Alex explain to all of us listening exactly what the Boondoggle podcast is. I've listened, you should too, but Alex, tell us why people should listen.
All right, first off, thanks again for having me. It's great to come on. I think we got a stellar topic coming on today, and I'm really excited to hit that. But long story short, the Boondoggle basically is a slice of life comedy podcast, kind of gives you a taste of what everyone experiences in their life. And we have a little bit of a darker sense of humor, so we twist everything, kind of like ramble off tangents, get a little bit going there. Have a musical guest every week, so we kind of offer everything for everybody. Give something that you can kind of relate to on like a normal life kind of schedule. It's really easy to pick up anywhere and no continuity. So, I mean, that's kind of what we live for.
Yeah, it's awesome. And you guys get quite deep and quite thoughtful sometimes about sort of the minutiae of topics. And I also found it interesting because I think there's a slight, and this is no problem, but I think there's a slight age difference between us. I think I'm slightly older. And so it was interesting getting a perception of, because I listened to some of your early, like your first like 10 episodes.
Oh God, I'm so sorry for you.
No.
I'm so sorry.
It was good. And then I was listening to the later episodes, and it was interesting kind of getting a view of a lot of the things that obviously we all go through in life and have people have been going through in life, whether they had technology or not, or, you know, whether they were in a public school or a private school or whatever kind of high school you're in, or whether it was, you know, Catholic or not, or whatever. Everyone's been through all these different kind of experiences, but like the way you were talking about it, I was like, oh, okay, that's not only familiar, because it was familiar to me, some of the stuff that you guys were talking about, but it was also completely different as well. Like, and it was interesting because I think that's where sort of true interest and creativity lies, is in something that is completely relatable, but at the same time is a new experience. So I'm learning, or I'm being able to empathize or sympathize or understand at the same time as relating to it. Does that make any sense?
It does, actually. And I mean, everyone has their own stories. Don't get me wrong. It's not like, oh, fuck, we're coming out with the hottest shit ever. But it's just everyone has their own stories. And it's nice to not only share the stories, but in the show format, kind of push it a little bit further, say the what ifs, twist it so that way it's just entertainment. I mean, long story short, think about it, like Seinfeld, it's normal stuff. He does normal things, but it's put in the context with the right people that we try to make it more than just, oh, the A to B. It's like A, B, and then Z, 2, 3, because we're also terrible at the alphabet. So that's fine, too.
Well, it's a great show, and I do urge everyone to go listen to it. By all means, tell them where they can find it now, but we will have a period at the end of the show where you can talk about your website as well. But tell everyone where they can find it, just in case they listen to this bit and then turn off.
Scare them away. Sorry for doing this to your show.
No, it's fine. Listen, I don't expect people to listen too long either, so it's fine.
All right, well, host site, you can find us on Spreaker, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, iHeartRadio, and Cornucopia Radio.
So wherever podcasts are found, find the Boondoggle Podcast.
Pretty much.
I strongly recommend it. So, again, I sort of, and I'm only assuming just based on some of the stuff you guys were talking about in the first few episodes, that there's a slight age gap. Well, tonight's show is going to be people can be listening to anytime. This show is all about comedy movies, specifically three 90s comedy movies that I revisited, that I remember watching when they came out, but I've now revisited, and we're going to kind of be looking at it. I have this theory that 90s comedies have not stood the test of time in the same way that 80s comedies do, but there's equally a theory that what I call the theory of James Bonds is that people's favorite James Bonds are the James Bonds they watched growing up. And so very often with comedies, with films, with things, whatever it is, it's your experience, it's the decade you grew up in, it's whatever it is. So maybe I'm just an old fart thinking that the 80s are better, and we're going to hash it out today. But why don't you tell us, Alex, where do you come at from comedy, and what was sort of your first few kind of tastes of either comedy television or comedy movies that you can remember from like your formative years?
Okay, so really fleshing this back, I did touch on 80s a lot. I touched on 90s more because obviously growing up in the 90s, that kind of stuff. But you actually recommended watching it today. I watched it a couple days ago, but Ace Ventura, Pet Detective.
Yeah.
I grew up on Jim Carrey. Jim Carrey was the go-to comedian, zany, funny, but also at the same time, if he had to be, real PG. Didn't break any walls if he didn't have to. But at the same time, Ace Ventura, Pet Detective in itself was the first movie that I hit, and I'm like, oh, this is great. Granted, I didn't understand half the jokes because I was too young, but watching it again the other day, I was dying. I thought it was hilarious.
And it's definitely one of those movies where it comes at the end of a run of movies where you could be PG-13, but still be, you know, there's a sex scene in there. There's the bit at the end with the stripping Sean Young. You know, there's subject matter in there that is not necessarily what would be in a PG-13 today. It's sort of on that line between PG-13 and R. And a lot of like 80s and early 90s comedies had that.
They pushed it. I mean, think about it. Going back the whole way to 1980 with Airplane,
yeah,
they had some girl topless just run across whenever mayhem was happening on the plane. And they're like, oh, that's PG-13. We'll throw that in there.
I never forget the beginning of John Candy's Who's Harry Crumb, which is not like a TNA comedy. It's not a sex romp. It's not like a police academy or anything like that. But for no apparent reason at the beginning, there's a girl in a spa, putting makeup on or whatever in a mirror, and for no apparent reason you can just see her boob, like it's just there because it's an 80s PG comedy, so we can show
exactly
boob. It's
the 80s, you were all about it.
Yeah, exactly. And it's kind of funny once you kind of get into the later 90s and the early millennium and you have comedy movies that are R-rated, and you go, well, there's no reason for anything in this to be R-rated just because they say a couple of boo-boo words. But anyway, it is what it is. So yeah, the three 90s comedies that I sort of declared, I guess, symbolize a certain period in the 90s, sort of three of the most kind of successful 90s comedies by three comedian, actor, writers who I think kind of epitomize that sort of big budget 90s comedies. And we'll get a little bit into later on the fact that there is also in the early 90s a burgeoning indie scene with people like Kevin Smith releasing Clerks and Dazed and Confused and films like that that maybe are still the kind of edgy,
classics.
Darker, yeah, they're great movies, but they're more the sort of underground, independent. You kind of found them if you were in that clique. But everyone saw these three movies, and we're talking Austin Powers, International Man of Mystery, Ace Ventura, Pet Detective, and Happy Gilmore. So you've got Adam Sandler, Jim Carrey, and Michael Myers, all of whom epitomized that era of sort of, what would you call it, the Hollywood studio comedies, I guess.
I mean, they were like straight out of SNL. They were the big names. They were the ones that walk out there saying, hey, we're funny guys. Let's just make movies. And they did a hell of a job.
Yeah, it's funny because SNL does kind of crop up time and time again as you kind of go through the last 30, 40 years of kind of comedy, especially in the US. And what's interesting is the waves of movies that kind of worked. And obviously there's the famous SNL movies that came out, whether it's Pat, the androgynous character, whether it's The Ladies' Man or some of those films. What's the one?
Don't even pass up on Tommy Boy. You got to throw that in there.
Coneheads.
Night at the Roxbury. Well, Coneheads.
I mean, Tommy Boy to some extent became a kind of favorite later on. Like, no, it wasn't a huge success when it came out, but it certainly became a favorite later on. But there were those SNL failures. But then you've got this wave, and they all start. You know, there's a story that a friend of mine tells, who was working on Airheads at the time with Adam Sandler, and the fact that he would work on Airheads, and then they would go over to the Wayne's World 2 set, because obviously they were all power. Chris Farley was on the Wayne's World 2 set, and Adam Sandler, and Mike Myers, and all these people. So, like, they all know each other. There's this big wave. It's all this stuff happening, and it's sort of like, it's post Eddie Murphy. It's post the 70s guys. So it's post Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd, all those guys. It's post the 80s, which is really kind of like Eddie Murphy. Jim Belushi comes out of SNL.
Bill Murray was big in the 80s too. So
right,
definitely group him in there.
Definitely. But he comes out of SNL in the 70s though. That's all I'm. So then in the 90s, you've got this wave with Mike Myers and Adam Sandler. And then it's not till like the Will Ferrell, Kristen Wiig era, which kind of comes about, what, 10 years later, something like that, about 9 years later, that you kind of get the next wave, I guess, from SNL.
I would almost argue, though, that the 90s was kind of held by Jim Carrey the most, because he had Ace Ventura in 1994. When Nature Calls came out in 1995. The Mask also came out in 1994. Cable Guy, 1996. And then Liar Liar, 1997.
Yeah, he is king of the Hollywood studio comedy. He is the big, big budget leader. And isn't he like one of the first to make over $10 million a movie or something? Like, he was one of the first guys to have his salary at such a high rate that it became headline news.
Yeah, definitely an impressive career. And I'm jealous to him to no extent, and I envy everything he's ever done.
So yeah, we have lots of wonderful internet comments and questions and things like that, which we will go to later. But let's start, for people who either haven't seen them or haven't seen them in a long time, let's quickly do like 5 to 10 minutes each on these movies, starting with, let's start with Happy Gilmore.
Sounds good.
Because in a weird way, although my feeling towards Adam Sandler, for some reason, I can sit and watch Adam Sandler movies, but I'm not entirely sure that Adam Sandler movies have ever made me like really laugh, like really, really laugh. I remember liking Anger Management when it came out, so I might kind of go back and watch that, but I also feel like that's probably more to do with Jack Nicholson than it is to do with him. But where did you come, like, with Happy Gilmore and Adam Sandler in general? Are you a fan of his, or was just Happy Gilmore one that you liked at the time, but you never kind of carried on down that Sandler road?
I kind of have a love-hate with Adam Sandler. I think it's mostly because once he had kids, he obviously came out and said, hey, I'm trying to make family-friendly movies, and I do respect that. But at the same time, you grew up on Adam Sandler being in the 90s. I mean, Happy Gilmore wasn't exactly one of my top ones. I'd put Big Daddy up there. Even his animated movie for the Christmas, Hanukkah season, Eight Crazy Nights, was actually one of his better movies. And Happy Gilmore, I played hockey, it was great watching like hockey player going golf. You saw the anger. You saw like him being an actor. It was kind of great. A lot of good moments, but I don't think it really lived up to what he had potential of.
Yeah, it's funny because it's Happy Gilmore is sort of one of those that everyone kind of talks about with hindsight. You know, obviously characters like Shooter McGavin and Carl Weathers character, I can't remember, but he has the fake hand and things like that. Yeah. And there's, you know, it, for a while people were like, oh, I know everyone hates Adam Sandler now, but have you seen Billy Madison and Happy Gilmore? Oh my God, they're so funny. I have to say, rewatching it now, and I haven't, I don't know when the last time I saw it, but rewatching it in this last week, I was sort of surprised at just how little I found funny anymore. And
it's a chuckle. It's a good chuckle.
There's the odd moment, and you know, I do love people getting angry and hitting each other, but it does kind of get a little ridiculous at a certain point. And this will tell you a bit more about my sense of humor. The funniest bit to me was when they're on the ice rink and they're on their date. And it's playing like some smooth music. And as it pulls back, the caretaker of the ice rink is like singing along to the music in like the foreground while they kiss and skate in the background. And that made me laugh. Like, I like kind of weird little surreal moments in his films. And there is a period of time a few years after this where he does more weird, surreal, mad bits in films. And then, like you say, kind of goes too far with the family-friendly route and too far with the almost just the repeating himself slapstick kind of stuff. And then the later stuff he's done for Netflix, I haven't even been able to get through it. I can't say that I was ever a fan of his, but for some reason, a bit like touching a sore tooth, if I see one of his films streaming, I'm like, I'll stick it on in the background while I do something else. I don't quite know why he's that guy for me, but apparently he is.
That's because his Netflix stuff is garbage. Right, the Do-Over really was the best one, and it was mostly because David Spade carried it. The Cobbler was terrible. I didn't think that was good at all. I didn't even bother with The Ridiculous Six. And he just keeps pumping movies out. He's like, I'm Adam Sandler. I'll just keep like going at it. But it's just every single person sees him, and the first thing you think of, Billy Madison, you think of Happy Gilmore, you think of Big Daddy, you think of the movies that made him. And he is, like, I would almost put him as, like, a higher up for slapstick comedy, because he had the normal scene, he's all calm and stuff, like Anger Management perfectly portrayed it, where he just flips to 180 and he's angry. And it's funny because it's such a shocking revelation for his character. And yeah. I think that's the only thing that was like retribution for him at all. That was the only thing keeping him alive.
Yeah, except that I do, you know, the thing that certainly the Adam Sandler films and Ace Ventura have in common, but Adam Sandler does this every single time out the gate, is that he's the, and I understand you've got to have a protagonist, you've got to have a hero, you've got to have someone that the audience are rooting for, but like he's rarely, even with the whole, oh, his short game is no good in golf and da 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 da, he's rarely fallible in these movies. Like, he's completely like, he's the hero, everyone loves him, everyone adores him, everyone else on the golf course is a dick. Like, it's
because he doesn't have anything redeeming about him, so they're like, let's make everyone else worse so you have to like this guy.
Right, but it's sort of a bit ridiculous. Like, the comedies of that we'll go through kind of talking about from the 80s, I feel, certainly if you think of someone like a Bill Murray or whatever, like, yes, of course he's the hero, yes, of course he's the protagonist in the movie or whatever it is, but he's also, you know, has a myriad of faults. Like, he feels like a real person. He feels like, you know, he has highs and lows and depths and, you know, he has neuroses and whatever. Whereas, you know, Adam Sandler characters, you go, yeah, well, okay, I have a short temper, but you're going to laugh at the short temper. So it's all right that I go around, like, going crazy, because you're going to laugh at it, because that's kind of the only joke that I've got kind of.
Well, that was the whole joke in The Waterboy. Right, that was the whole Waterboy. It was, he had a short temper. It literally made it a plot point, and you're just like, oh, there he goes off the leash again. That wild goose, him. He's wild.
Well, that's what's funny about Anger Management, is that essentially it's him recognizing that, I guess. Like, he's saying, I've played all these characters.
It's actually an intervention.
Yeah, right. It's actually an intervention for his film career, and I think that's probably why it's my favorite. But I can't say that I'm never going to put him on any kind of pedestal in terms of comedians. I can't say that I've ever heard his stand-up outside of that movie that he did, Funny People. I've not heard any of his albums, which I know went like multi-platinum. Like he's one of the biggest, highest selling stand-up comedians of all time. And yet I've never heard his stand-up. It's a bit like Jay Leno. Everyone talks about before Jay Leno was doing the talk show, he was one of the funniest stand-ups ever. I've watched stand-ups people have never heard of. I have never seen a Jay Leno stand-up special, if it exists. I don't know if it's out there, whether you can hear it. Like, it's so weird. Like, I'm a huge Carlin fan. I knew Bill Hicks and, you know, all those guys. But, like, I've seen a Seinfeld stand-up special. Never seen a Leno one. Never seen a Sandler one. So, I don't know. People say they're great, but I've no idea on how to judge them on their stand-up.
Don't get me wrong. I'm in the same boat. Adam Sandler, I mean, he sang the Hanukkah songs, and those were a big thing. He made, like, 4 fucking versions or something of it. But he did that. Jay Leno, never seen stand-up of him. I didn't even know he did stand-up, to be honest. I thought he was just, like, The Late Show or whatever, The Tonight Show. Right.
Yeah.
But if you're looking at big stand-up names that really, like, transitioned well, it would be Eddie Murphy with his stand-up. What was it, Raw?
Raw, yeah. And
Raw was probably one of the better stand-ups. And then you also had, oh, my God, Robin Williams. I love Robin Williams' stand-up.
Yeah, Robin Williams' stand-up's great. Yeah, I mean, Eddie Murphy's stand-up, it's one of those things, again, at the time, you know, was hugely popular. Everyone watched those tapes. Everyone loved those tapes. And I remember people sharing his stand-up videos around at university and all sorts of stuff. However, like, when you watch them back now, you kind of realize just how kind of...
They're dated.
Rough and crude and dated, and it's not just about being un-PC, it's just about being kind of bad at a certain point or ignorant at a certain point.
It was all ignorant. I actually have Raw on vinyl in my room. Yeah. I have the vinyl tape and I listen to it, and don't get me wrong, it skips because it's old as hell, but I listen to it and I'm like, this is different. I'm used to him being family-friended, haunted, like the Haunted Mansion.
Yeah,
that's what I expect whenever I think of him, and all of a sudden he's just like going off the handle, and I'm like, huh, he has potential. He's a different soul.
Yeah, and it's, you know, comedy is difficult because when you go back too far, or you go back to things that at the time seemed very edgy and different, now you're kind of going, well, I don't even know. Like, I remember watching some of Richard Pryor's stuff is great, but I remember watching some of the lesser known Richard Pryor stand-ups that were kind of released after his death. I remember watching them going, yeah, I don't really know how he it just didn't. And it wasn't that he was speaking about stuff that I hadn't lived. It was just stuff that I was like, yeah, I don't really get, like, what's a joke about this. Whereas I can listen to Carlin in any decade, it doesn't matter if it's Carlin from the early 70s all the way through to Carlin before he died, and every single set I laugh at, whether it's his silly stuff, political stuff, religious stuff, whatever it is, like I laugh at all of it. Like, it's far more all-encompassing for me than some of the other stuff. But anyway, so we've diverted onto stand-up just because that's kind of...
I mean, they all did it.
They all did it, right. They all came from that. And, Eddie, you know, I feel like Eddie Murphy did, like, 2 sets and then went, all right, I've used that to catapult my career, now I'm just going to go off and be an actor, because he hasn't done stand-up in like 30 years and everyone's like, oh, go back to stand-up. We're like, well,
you can't just go back to the same river.
I think his ego has got to the point where he just won't do it anymore. And so, yeah, so Adam Sandler, Happy Gilmore, I have to give it, with hindsight, I have to give it, like, out of, let's do it out of 5. It's easier out of 5. I'm going to give it 2 out of 5. There's a couple of moments in there where I'm passably amused, and it's nice to see. I think it's nice to see some of the cameos that he has in there, and some of the other actors that you'll see he use time and time again throughout his films, and it's kind of fun to see those guys. You know, and there's a couple of good bits, but I mean, ultimately, if I never saw it again, I wouldn't miss it. What about yourself?
Okay, 2 out of 5 for you. I grew up on it. I have to give it a 3 at least. It is something that, like, it's tolerable. It's something that if you don't find a movie that you want to watch, you'll be like, oh, Happy Gilmore, this is something I've related to in the past. Let's try to reconcile with my feelings from before, and hopefully we get the same reaction.
Yeah. I mean, I still say that there's never been a truly great golf comedy. people are going to go, but what about Caddyshack? And I'm like, there is about 20 minutes of good material in Caddyshack, and the rest of Caddyshack is horseshit.
I'm gonna have to go against you on that one. It was just so dry that I did enjoy the whole movie, and I would almost put that as, yeah, it would be higher than Happy Gilmore. Happy Gilmore was just kind of
don't get me wrong.
Adam Sandler.
Don't get me wrong. Caddyshack is higher than Happy Gilmore, but it's not...
it's not wild. It's just there.
I remember watching Caddyshack. Like, obviously, Caddyshack is one of those that when, you know, people are talking about great comedies and Bill Murray and Chevy Chase and the post-SNL crowd, they're like, oh, you have to watch Caddyshack. It's hilarious. The trouble with Caddyshack is all the stuff that isn't Bill Murray and Chevy Chase. Like, Bill Murray and Chevy Chase were amazing in it. They're, like, the best thing in it. And then everyone else.
Yeah.
Is not very good. Even Rodney Dangerfield, who is very good in the movie and very funny in the movie, even his shtick gets tired about 25% of the way through. And then the rest of it is all the kid stuff, and the kid stuff is all it's not quite a sex romp in the way that
it's a sex romp. Yeah, it's like a Fast Times at Ridgemont High on a golf course,
right? It's all the kid stuff, and I have no interest in any. But Bill Murray and Chevy Chase, like, the movie should be about those two guys.
Dangerfield, like, actually by the end of the movie, I hated his guts. His character was supposed to be funny and wild and carefree, but by the end you realize he's an asshole, and you're like, I'm not digging this anymore.
Yeah, it is a funny thing. You go back to stuff that you've watched before and enjoyed, and then kind of looking at it going, I don't know why I enjoy that anymore. So, Happy Gilmore, I mean, if I have to give Sandler props on any films, it's probably like The Wedding Singer has its moments, Anger Management has its moments, and that's about it for me, I think. I quite liked when it came out, Don't Mess with the Zohan, because it was just so ridiculously stupid.
It was.
And I liked the fact that he did something that was just balls to the wall, completely stupid. But that hasn't aged well either.
None of his stuff ages well. It's just kind of like goes in the vault. It sits there and you might check it out again.
Yeah. So that was Happy Gilmore. Then we watched, let's go on to Ace Ventura, which I think is probably going to be the most divisive one between the two of us. Because I think for you, it's a movie that means a lot more to you, I think. Just from your comments.
It's a must-see.
Than to me. So... my history with Ace Ventura very quickly was, I remember it being a VHS that I watched probably somewhere in my mid to late teens. And I remember it was before Jim Carrey was a household name. And I remember just kind of watching it and being like, oh, wow, you know, this is something different. He's, you know, weird and wonderful, and he's doing voices and pulling faces and da 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 da. And, you know, that's very... He was a bit like a more structured, I guess, or more polished Jim Varney from the Ernest movies.
Yeah.
But it wasn't something that you totally hadn't seen before, but it was certainly something new and fresh. And everyone I knew at the time was being like, all righty then. Like, everyone was doing that when that movie came out.
I still do it. It's like, it's still in there. You tuck it in there, all right? You can't forget that.
Like Einhorn tucked it back, yeah.
Oh, God. That shouldn't have been a PG-13 movie.
You have some good sequences in there and so on. Another one like Happy Gilmore, hadn't seen it probably in at least a decade, if not longer. And putting it back on, obviously, the shtick is not going to feel as fresh as it did the first time you see it. Like, the shtick is going to feel a little overdone at this point, just because you've seen him do it in other films. Secondly, I didn't really have, like yourself, I didn't have any nostalgia for the film. Like, it was a movie that came out and I watched at the time, and Jim Carrey became a thing with, like you say, Liar Liar and The Mask and The Truman Show and other films like that. And he became a big, big deal for that kind of decade. And I remember sort of very quickly leaping off the Carrey train and being like, okay, a couple of movies were fine, but I'm not sure I can watch this all the time. So there was certain... I didn't have any kind of, like, nostalgia love for it. So watching it this time, you know, the shtick gets tired for me. There are some funny bits in it, but the whole last section with the reveal of the twist that Sean Young used to be a man, the reaction to that now, it's just... And it's not even like, I'm not one to be like, oh, you know, transphobic or homophobic, although it is both those things. I'm not necessarily one to bring like a PC eye on something. It was just, it wasn't so much that, it was just that it didn't sit right to me because I didn't, like, it just wasn't funny. Like, it seemed really odd that would be
it was a different pace. It was a different pace to the whole movie. The whole movie was Ace being the weird one and everyone reacting to Ace. And then at the end of the movie, it was Ace doing the big reveal. And everyone had, like, the most offhand reaction. The dolphin got its fun little bits in there, too. And as soon as you bring the animal in and make the dolphin do funny stuff or try to be, like, relatable in any sense whatsoever, it kind of just got overbearing.
Well, I think there was any number of jokes you could have made about the reveal, and instead the joke they went for is that she's made out with everyone, and everyone is horrified to have made out with a man. Like, that was the joke they went with. So that everyone's, like, spitting or chewing gum or whatever it is, and it's like, well, there's any number of jokes you could have made about it, especially the way she had been with everyone in the past, you know, when everyone just thought she was a regular Einhorn. But, like, it just sits really weird at the end of the movie. Like, it's meant to be this big laugh, ha 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 ha, but it kind of isn't anymore when you watch it. It's just kind of uncomfortable and unnecessary when you watch it. So I think that does hurt the film with modern eyes. I think if you go back to watch it now, it definitely, the last act hurts the film. I still think there's some good stuff up front. I love all the stuff he does where he's doing the Star Trek voices when he's in the swimming pool. And I still love the bit where he goes outside on the balcony and opens and shuts the door with the, like, I love that business. But ultimately for me, I was hoping this was going to be the one that I would be at the end of the show, be like, that was the funny one out of the three that still stuck around. But I'm not sure that's the case. What about yourself? So you now sing its praises or whatever you want to say.
I'm going to be honest. It's going to be my favorite. I'm going to spoil that already. So I'm already, like, foreshadowing what I think of Austin Powers when I say this. Ace Ventura was hands down the best one. I enjoyed every moment of it. The ending, granted, you were completely correct. It was overbearing. They overdid the joke. The construction of the movie up until that point was amazing. I loved everything about it because it was Jim Carrey being Jim Carrey. But I don't want to just rip on this back end of it, but that back end was so bad. It was just so bad. And when he got committed to the psych ward, when he wore the tutu and he was the athlete, the first time I didn't really think about the severity of the situation and what they were making fun of, because obviously I was a little kid. And then all of a sudden I go back and watch it again, and I'm like, oh shit, that's, like, really deep, dark, and really funny in a weird way. So he did a great things. The Star Trek voices in the beginning was probably one of the better lines in the whole movie, but it was the social anxiety and, like, how he blatantly portrayed how bad he is with people that made it better. And he doesn't do that in Liar Liar. He doesn't do that in, okay, I'm gonna bring it up, the number 23.
Wow, you traveled the Carrie train all the way to that.
I did. I'm not okay. Gonna lie, that's probably one of my favorite Carrie movies.
Oh wow, okay.
It caught me off guard, but, like, in every single movie, he's kind of a normal guy. The Mask, he's a normal guy, but he obviously acts out. But this is one of the only movies where he is wild Jim Carrey 24/7, and it's just everyone reacting to this guy.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was certainly an interesting idea. You go, well, how do we take someone like Carrey, who, again, stand up, had done In Living Color, so he'd done stand up, he'd done sketch comedy. Like, how do we take his shtick and put it in a movie, right? Like, there weren't movies around that would necessarily hold that, until something like The Mask comes along. But even then, you're just like, well, what do we do? So it's interesting that you come up with a character like Ace Ventura, who it's definitely in the long line of characters, whether it's Fletch, whether it's Jim Belushi in the K-9 movies, whether it's Whoopi Goldberg in Jumpin' Jack Flash or whatever it is, like those characters where it's a mystery movie, it's a whodunit movie, But in the center of it, we've got like a wacky comedian character, fish out of water type, who's dealing with the either the real world or the serious world around him. And it does allow, like, throughout the film, he's able to do voices and faces, and he's able to, you know, do the stand-up commentary on stuff like head injuries in Major League Football and things like that. So there's all that kind of stuff going on. But the thing that dates it, the big thing that dates it, and the big thing that is very, very tone deaf about it is the...
People care about the Dolphins?
No, the big thing that's kind of tone deaf about it is the female roles in the movie, and how much they are, like, sidelined or marginalized or objectified. And then the incredibly, like, at this point, transphobic reaction to the twist. It's just, I can't, like, even in the 90s, it would seem weird to me that, like, that was such a big joke. Anyway, I mean, I don't want to keep going on about it, but that to me kind of is definitely the sort of difficult territory. And even Courtney Cox's role in it is just...
I thought she was, like, good.
She is good in it, considering, but... At the same time, I mean, first of all, if you spent 30 seconds with Ace Ventura, you'd be like, all right, I can't.
You can't do it. Yeah.
I can't deal with this guy. I'm going to leave. Like, that's the first thing. You wouldn't find it oddly charming, because there's nothing oddly charming about him.
I thought there was.
Nah, not to me. I would find him utterly irritating after about 10 minutes. And I know all the characters do at the beginning and they kind of warm to him, but... There isn't enough humanity in that character, I think, to really, even the animal thing, you'd think the fact that he loved and cared for and nurtured for animals would be an emotional linchpin in the movie that you could kind of go, well, yeah, okay, he's not good with humans, but, like, he's really good with animals and stuff. But, like, even that isn't played up for any kind of emotive reason. It's just what he does in order to, like, facilitate the movie, I guess.
Okay, well, whenever I say it was charming, I think the reason is bringing Adam Sandler into this to foil them together. Adam Sandler's whole stick is get angry. And what comes of that? Yelling, punching, screaming, and, like, vulgarity. But with Ace Ventura or Jim Carrey's character, what comes of being crazy is unpredictable. And that's whenever it branches out to, like, the comedic genius of being able to do other things. And I think that's what I found so charming about the character was because, I mean, the voices, he a million voices in one kind of thing, where he was a jack of all trades in every single situation. And even though the script did him a ton of justice, where he came up with on the spot, like, reactions, witty humor, and I think that's what actually propelled his character to be so likable. But I understand where you're coming from inside the universe. The characters wouldn't like him. They would think, oh, dear God, he's in public again. Put, like, an arm's length away.
No, it's more that... So in Ace Ventura, there is the cliche that's in a lot of, like, 80s and 90s action-adventure comedies or detective comedies or whatever you want to sort of brand them at, which is that you have the rival police team who are always, like, picking on them or, like, attacking them or whatever. There's a, I don't know if you've ever seen it, but, like, the Emilio Estevez, Charlie Sheen film, Men at Work, there's, like, rival garbage men who are, like, they want to be, like, the A squad, but...
I mean, that's literally, like, Will Ferrell, Mark Wahlberg, the other guys.
Right. But yeah, I mean, it goes way, way back. But essentially, yeah. The idea is that the lead guy that we're following is the cool one that we all want to be, and the kind of miserable, grumpy sidekicks are the ones that are trying to foil his every move and fail. And with normally in that situation, the leading guys are, you know, they're cool, they're laid back, they're relaxed, they have their little stuff, and they have maybe, like, quips or whatever, but they're not like full of themselves. They're not normally, like, egotistical, but in Ace
like Bill Murray in Stripes.
Right. he's not egotistical. He doesn't think like he's the greatest thing ever. He's just a laid back, you know, devil may care, you know, guy with a quip for everything. But he's not, he doesn't think like he's the greatest thing ever.
True,
whereas there are certain scenes in Ace Ventura, especially when he's trying to get the better of the police force, where it's all about like, I am the shit. Like, there is no one better than me. And that's what knocks the charm off for me, because it's not about the fact that he's right anymore, even though he is right about the clues. It's just the fact that he A, knows he's right, B, shows off the fact that he knows that he's right, and C, takes sort of such delight in it that you kind of go, well, I get it. I get what you're doing. I get the cliche. I get where it came from. I get the whole thing. But like, ultimately, that's what, as I said, lacks some of the charm of someone like a Bill Murray or Tom Hanks in Dragnet or whatever. Like, or Fletch, even. You know, Fletch is, you know, very laid back, is always right, you know, takes no prisoners. But at the same time, it doesn't come across as sort of like arrogant or egotistical. Do you know what I mean?
Well, I mean, playing devil's advocate a little bit too.
Of course, go right ahead. Yeah,
when
yeah.
when he's talking to Courtney Cox's character, well, that's fun to say. Anyways, when he's talking to her, he explains like about the ring. He's like, "This is missing. This is exactly where it came from. We need to find this." And he's just straightforward about it with a little bit of charm. But when it comes to the police force, I think the reason why he's all up in their face is because it's kind of like a big stick policy where it's like, "Hey, I have the answer, but if you're gonna attack me on this, I'm gonna put you back in your place."
Yeah, no, and I do get that about it. I just mean there was something about it for me where I'm like, it could have just been written in a way where it didn't come across quite so self-aggrandizing, I guess. It's very comparable, weirdly enough, to the way that both Downey Jr. and Cumberbatch played Sherlock Holmes in their various different ways, in the sense that Sherlock Holmes was never written as a character who's just like, I am the greatest thing ever. He happens to be, and he happens to be aware of the fact that he has a gift that other people don't have, but he's never arrogant or swanky or egotistical with it. But the way Cumberbatch and Downey Jr. play the thing, or rather the way it's written in those two things, and the thing that it gets wrong about Sherlock Holmes is the fact that not only are they the greatest thing ever, but they rub it in everyone's faces and they walk around like they own the joint. And it's just a bit like that character isn't meant to be that way, you know? And in a way, it's the thing that kind of turns me off a little bit about it. And certainly with this rewatch. But again, as I say, it's going to be one of those things where those movies hit me at a sweet spot when I was like 17, 18, you know, young and dumb. And therefore, I was probably, you know, and so with hindsight, watching them now, you know, almost pushing 40, it's just not going to do the same thing for me. So I completely take that it's unfair of me to kind of sit there and rip on the movie. If there's someone who's discovering the movie for the first time, they're going to have fun with it up until the last act.
All right, so hit me with that Roman thumb. Out of 5, what do you give it?
Well, it certainly has more laughs in it than Happy Gilmore, so I have to go higher than Happy Gilmore. I'll go 3 out of 5 with it. I was gonna go 2.5, but I'll go 3 out of 5 with it.
Ooh, you're killing me. I feel like everything you say, I'm just gonna like put 1 on top of it, but I'm giving it a 4.
That's fine, man. That's fine. And like I say, I've always said whenever I started this show, this is not a movie podcast that tells people how to think or states that my opinion is better than anyone else's or your opinion is better than anyone else's. Everyone can have their opinion and everyone likes what they like. And I love to hear impassioned defenses of stuff that I don't like in the same way that I like to be passionate about stuff that I do to people who might not feel the same way.
and the show by saying, I'm going to kick your ass.
Yeah, right. You know, we're the one show that hasn't done a fucking Star Wars episode, and there's a reason for that. But, go ahead, dude.
I was just going to say, I still haven't seen it, and I need to. I need to so bad. It'll probably be tomorrow. It'll be the next day. I swear, I keep putting it off. It's like laundry.
I still haven't seen Rogue One, so don't worry about it. I'm way behind.
Ooh. Ooh, you're missing the best.
It's not my franchise, dude. Not my thing.
Fair enough.
It's all good. No. I mean, I don't have any like strong opinions either way. It's just not my thing. And with a movie coming out every single year now, I'm just like, yeah, I'm not going to catch up on those. So the last movie then is Austin Powers International Man of Mystery. And I will tell you this, that going in to rewatching these three movies, this was the movie that I had thought with hindsight, because again, haven't watched it in a decade. Haven't watched any of the Austin Powers probably in a decade. And my memory of the movie was like, ah, this is going to be the one that proves my point. This is going to be the one that doesn't stand up. This is going to be the one that is no longer funny. And this is the one that I'm going to have the biggest problem with, because I thought that this was very much of its time. I'm going to say that I had a different opinion coming out of it, but let's go to you. When was the first time you saw Austin Powers, and what's your overall feeling? Did you go with the sequels? Do you like it? What was your thing?
Okay, so by how you preface that, we're going to have a little bit of a different view on this one.
Of course, it's fine.
I remember it in hindsight being hilarious. The shotgun of the movies, like, it was the best thing I've ever seen. And I went back and watched it yesterday, exactly yesterday. And I watched it, and obviously the cliche, the parody of the spy who's the sex symbol. It's like the James Bond, but he's British and just wild and crazy. And it's, don't get me wrong, Mike Myers is great. But watching it again, it was actually, except for maybe two or three parts, it was painful to me. It was overbearing at times. The jokes, maybe it's because I've remembered these jokes for year after year after year, and in my mind, you know how those jokes kind of flash back in your head? I think it was just like oversaturated that it wasn't standing up for me. It was just, I was watching it and kind of remembering watching it, but it, International Man of Mystery did not hold up. And then I went on and watched The Spy Who Shagged Me, and that didn't hold up either. And then I watched Goldmember, and I'm like, why did I just spend 6 hours today? What am I doing with my life?
So I'm interested. A lot of people often see Austin Powers as more or less a Bond parody, and there was certainly a lot of Bond stuff in there. In fact, I was just watching the other night the documentary on Bond, Everything or Nothing, and Mike Myers crops up in that saying, you know, Bond was a family favorite in our household. A lot of Austin Powers is clearly based on James Bond, et cetera, et cetera. And it is to some extent. The, you know, Mike Myers is from British parents who ended up moving to Canada, and then he himself obviously came down to America. But he grew up with, you know, Monty Python and Peter Sellers. And...
Oh, don't even get me started on Monty Python. They are geniuses.
Oh, no, I love Monty Python. I'm probably one of the biggest Python fans on the planet in terms of like all the stuff that I've read about obscure TV shows they did before and after Python and seeing films no one else has ever seen. Like, I'm a huge Python mark, but I'm just saying that Mike Myers grew up watching a bunch of stuff, and there's stuff in Austin Powers that it's not just from Bond. There's stuff in there that is from like Peter Sellers movies, the spoof movie Casino Royale, which came out before the Bond movies really kicked off with David Niven and Peter Sellers and Woody Allen in it. There is What's New Pussycat, which was again another Peter Sellers, Woody Allen, Peter O'Toole film that came out. There's stuff from the Beatles movies in there, from Help and Hard Day's Night. There's stuff from Alfie and some of those early Michael Caine movies.
It was all pop culture. It was just a pure pop culture movie.
Yeah, and it's the reason why I thought it would have dated, because the thing I remember coming out of Austin Powers originally when it first came out, the thing I remember was everyone dressed up as Austin Powers for the, you know, office Christmas and or Halloween party. Everyone went round saying, "Oh, behave," all the time, and it wasn't funny. Like, it was one of there's an interesting thing about Monty Python and other things that I've liked. When other people repeat the catchphrases back to me, I cringe. I don't find them funny. And when people go around and sort of say catchphrases to stuff, Lego Behave and, you know, Shagadelic and all that kind of stuff. I remember it being on, like, Hallmark cards for, like, a decade. You could buy, like, Austin Powers fucking Hallmark cards and Austin Powers Halloween costumes and Austin Powers this and Austin Powers that. And I was like, I mean, I understand they did, like, two sequels and they had, like, lots of famous people in them and it became, like, a phenomena. But, you know, it was very irritating, the kind of fallout from that, like everyone walking around being like, yeah, baby, yeah. And I was like, oh, fuck, that's awful.
Which famous person were you talking about? Were you talking about Mike Myers or were you talking about Mike Myers? Because it really depends on the movies.
Oh, no, I meant the sequels have that that whole thing with Tom Cruise and Gwyneth Paltrow and all those people in it at the opening and all that sort of stuff. So, I thought going back into it this time that Austin Powers would be the one that I would be like, yeah, I knew it. 90s comedies are crap. The interesting thing about it, though, is because enough time has passed and because it's not based purely on a Bond pastiche. There's all this other stuff in there that is kind of dear to my heart and stuff that I kind of grew up watching, like the kind of weird early 60s, swinging 60s Peter Sellers stuff or Beatles stuff or whatever it is, or Michael Caine stuff. That weirdly, it hasn't aged in the way that Ace Ventura has aged or Happy Gilmore has aged. Like, I feel like those two movies have aged, whereas I feel like Austin Powers, because it's set in the 60s and the 90s, but it's not set in a realistic 90s and it's not even set in a realistic 60s. So it sort of exists out of time, and therefore it hadn't aged because of that. What was interesting coming out of it this time is that Austin Powers is the worst character in the movie. Like, he's the least funny character in the film.
He actually is.
He really is. He has, like, two or three good moments. Like, the bit where he says, Carnies, very small hands, smell of cabbage. Like, that's fantastic. But, like, apart from that, most of what he says about trying to get, what's her name, into bed? I forget her name off the top of my head.
She's disgustingly hot.
Elizabeth Hurley. She's atrocious actress, though. She cannot act her way out of a bag. And she's like, she just makes me cringe the whole film. I'm just like, oh, get someone who can deliver a line properly. But, like, the Dr. Evil character is still funny. Like, I don't know how it's possible that he's still funny, because I would have thought that he wasn't funny. But he's still funny. In fact, any time you're around Dr. Evil and Scott and Frau Farbissner and all that kind of stuff, I'm endlessly amused. Like, when he sits down, even when he sits on the chair and the chair, like, wheels away and he has to, like, scoot back up to the table. Like, even stuff like that, like, I just think is really well done for what it is. I love Basil Exposition, Michael York showing up as that character. I think he has some good lines. I think it's well done in terms of its music and its style and its knockabout nature. I mean, there's no real, like, serious plot to it. There's no real attempt to kind of have any character arc or anything like that. There's, you know, there's this, the moment where he kind of goes back through the 30 years that he's missed and tries to kind of humanize himself a little bit. But ultimately, it's a cartoon, right? The whole film is kind of a cartoon. But I actually, of the three movies that I rewatched, this was the one I had the most fun with. This was the one I laughed the most at. Not all of it. It has huge faults, and there's, you know, like a lot of Mike Myers' stuff, even like Wayne's World, there's a tendency to just repeat the same gags over and over again. And it gets even worse during the sequels, where, you know, they repeat the same gag over and over and over and over again through multiple films. But essentially, I found this movie to be the funniest and most charming out of the three. I still don't think it knocks any 80s comedy off the high shelf that I put 80s comedies on, but I think out of this three, it was the one that I had the most fun with.
I'm going to have to put it as the least fun. I'm just going to throw it down there that, granted, okay, Mike Myers, charming. Vanessa, what's her name? Oh my God.
Elizabeth Hurley.
That's how memorable she was.
Yeah.
Her being in there was actually better than Mike Myers, which was horrible to say, and I feel bad for him. But the whole movie, the only fun that I found in it was how cliche it was, how it was exactly pop culture. If you took a picture of the 70s and you said, pick out everything 70s in this, it was in that movie. So it was nice seeing that. It was like kind of like a time capsule shoved in there. but it wasn't an accurate time capsule. Like, someone messed with it somewhere along the lines. But it was still charming. But that was the only thing that I found that was remotely attractive about this movie. Everything else was so... it was bland. Like, the catchphrases, like, oh, behave and all that stuff, it was overplayed in society. So whenever you watch the movie, you're just like, Jesus, I heard it one more time. Oh, my God.
Yeah, no, completely. The catchphrases don't hold up at all, and they are the most irritating thing about it. Although I will say this one thing. Out of the three movies, in terms of sexual politics, even though the character is trying to shag everything that moves, this movie has the best sexual politics out of the three of them. In terms of the fact that Elizabeth Hurley's character is not a pushover. Elizabeth Hurley character is made to be an intelligent agent that handles weaponry and knows what Austin is about. Like, the joke is on Austin. The joke is not on the women. Whereas in both Happy Gilmore, Julie Bowen's character essentially is there to be won over by Happy Gilmore, ogled by Happy Gilmore. There's even a dream sequence where she's in lingerie twice. Like, there's no character there in terms of what she's playing. And same with kind of Courtney Cox. And even though I think Julie Bowen and Courtney Cox are fine in the respective roles, it's no comment on them acting-wise. The sexual politics of both those films is not particularly informed. And I'm not saying that Austin Powers is, like, the most informed, you know, feminist liberal movie. You know, I'm not an idiot. But, like, there is a certain thing that it's commenting on. There are comments about everything from the 60s sexual revolution and what they were trying to achieve. And there's even a bit where Austin would say, like, even if that wasn't the case, we still would have tried to have fought for this and da 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 da. Like, there's some understanding there in that movie that I think a little bit more knowledgeable and a little bit knowing, and at least doesn't treat its female characters with irrelevance in the same way that the other movies do. For me, from the way
I I hope I never get quoted on this, but I feel that sex was gracefully handled in Austin Powers. And that is something that I never thought I would say in my life, but I think it was handled very well.
Right. I mean, yeah, there's not... it's not quite as... I just think the characters that both Jim Carrey and Adam Sandler play in the other movies are very much like... oh, I know that I'm going to get you, and I know that we're going to have sex. But there's no real interest in either of the people as people or as characters or as anything other than a hot woman to go to bed with. And they're so sure of themselves, and they're so, you know, their ego is so on display, and it's so sort of male and machismo and all the rest of it. Whereas... like I say, in Austin Powers, the joke is on Austin. Like, he does a whole bit with the Swedish dick pump.
Yeah, the penis pump.
Where you're like, you know, he's making himself fallible. He's making himself this idiot with, like, pretensions of grandeur without actually being grand at all. Whereas Ace Ventura and Happy Gilmore both think that they're fucking the best thing on two legs. Whereas Austin Powers, in the back of his mind, knows that he isn't. He just, you know what I mean? Like, there's something about that. Anyway,
he puts up a front the whole time, and especially whenever the one redeeming scene where he sits down and catches up on the 80s and the 90s and the cassettes, it shows, like, his character watching it, and that was the most human scene that he had, where it's like, yeah, this is just a guy trying to get through stuff, and granted, he's the sex symbol of the 70s, and the best buy ever, he still has more to his character than just that.
Yeah, completely. So with those three movies talked about, we're going to go on to the comment section and then do a little...
Oh, slow down. We never rated it.
Oh, we didn't rate it. Okay.
You can't jump past it.
Well, I'm gonna surprise everybody, and I'm going to give this one a 4 out of 5.
Ooh, okay. I guess... wow, we really sit between those. We never give it like a 1 or a 5.
none of them are fives.
it's gonna hit a 2 or 2.5 for me, somewhere in there. That's gonna sit for probably 2, 2.5.
Yeah, that's fine. And I understand. And it may have just been, you know, movies very much are the mood you see them in, right? Or the history you have with them, or the
yeah,
you know. So there's a lot built into it that I wasn't and also the fact that I had no expectation of liking this movie again. Like, this was the movie that I was like, I'm sure I'm going to hate this.
Okay, see, I wasn't expecting to love this. I'm like, oh, this will be the one that knocks me off my feet.
Yeah, and so often the way, it depends on your expectation going into the film.
The After Movie Diner with John Cross will return right after this.
Welcome to the Boondoggle Podcast. My name's Alex.
And I'm Dimitri, and here at the Boondoggle, we are a comedy podcast created by two pals with dark humor to entertain the masses.
Did you just finger guns me when you did that?
Absolutely, Alex.
Why would you do that?
Because finger guns are the most genuine way to get your point across when you're trying to say something absolutely, like, irrelevant and not believable.
I hate myself. Finger guns.
Finger it's guns.
Like, he really meant it. This guy's for real.
He's so genuine. Look at this guy. I appreciate that honesty.
It's like, this guy, he's getting a promotion. He's like, what? Oh my god. Finger guns the boss. He's like, god damn, you're my boss now.
You're my boss now.
Anyways. Tune into us. You can hear us on a lot of sites. iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher, TuneIn, Google Play, anywhere pretty much. And be able to tune in every single Friday to hear what we have to say. Once again, signing off, my name's Alex.
I'm Dimitri.
And this is the Boondoggle Podcast.
Hi, I'm Mark James from the popular Poop Culture Podcast. I'm here today to talk to you about a serious matter millions of Americans struggle with each and every day. Do you suffer from a moderate to severe disinterest in life? Have you or a loved one been diagnosed with social perplexia, a general knowledge deficiency? Then Poop Culture, with all the snatch-em-in, may be right for you. The Poop Culture Podcast gives you your minimum daily required allowance of popular culture, comedy, and general tomfoolery. Please operate heavy machinery while listening to Poop Culture. If you achieve an erection lasting more than 4 hours, then good for you. Side effects may include, but are not limited to, nausea, diarrhea, general sense of euphoria, hallucinations, side and stomach cramps, social gaping, anal leakage, and dry mouth. Listen to the Poop Culture Podcast and gain the confidence you need to relate to people once again. No need to ask your doctor, because Poop Culture is right for you.
Poop culture, yeah, it's a poop culture.
You're listening to the sweet sounds of the After Movie Diner. Support us at patreon.com/aftermoviediner, or I'll punch you in the teats. Rate and review us on iTunes, Earthling.
All right, so we are now going to comments on the internet. We put it out there on our social media feeds. 90s comedies versus 80s comedies. We want your opinion. And obviously, like I said, probably just because of my age group or something like that, my friends are probably going to be a tad biased towards my opinion of 80s comedies. We will have a little chat about 80s comedies after we run through these comments. So Andrew Morris says, 80s comedies never neglected to tell a great, sometimes touching story. 90s comedies were more of a gag reel tied together with a flimsy line, with the exception of a few. Be interested to know what he feels, which are the few. Austin Rogers. Now, I don't know if you're a Jeopardy fan, sir, but Austin Rogers was the man who took Jeopardy by storm this summer and won just shy of $500,000 on Jeopardy. My fiance happens to know him, so he is going to chime in now. 2017's Jeopardy celebrity Austin Rogers says, I want to say the 80s wins because I just associate 90s with The Mask, which I think is a crushing indictment of The Mask. I think that's what he's saying. So Tim Gross from Gross Movie Reviews and from the Bloodbath and Boomstick podcast, he says, Hot Dog the Movie, end of conversation. Are you aware of Hot Dog the Movie, sir, from the 80s?
Not a clue. As soon as you said that, I've been listening. I was like, yeah, okay, I see where they're coming from. And then all of a sudden, Hot Dog, I was like, what? Sorry, excuse me?
Hot Dog the Movie, that's kind of a joke from Tim. It's an 80s sex romp set at a ski school. That's his kind
of most 80s thing I've ever heard.
Yeah. It's Hot Dog the Movie, it's kind of great and kind of awful at the same time, but it's worth a watch. Joss Stewart says, I'd probably go with the 80s overall, but last night I watched European Vacation, and I don't know if I'll ever be able to laugh again. He says, I basically stopped laughing as soon as John Astin and Paul Bartel exited the picture. Clark turned from an asshole bad husband father in the first movie to a specially designed stupid actions machine in European, and I just couldn't take it. I don't know if I recently watched Christmas Vacation again. I'm a big fan of the vacation movies. What's your feeling very quickly on Chevy Chase and any of his films?
Not bad. Real indifferent. It's a hit or miss kind of thing.
Have you seen Fletch?
I have not, actually, no.
Okay. Fletch, hands down, I think is the best Chevy Chase film. I'm a huge Fletch fan. His one-liners in Fletch are just fantastic. My friend Matt from England then went on about British comedy in general. He was like, are we discussing comedy on both sides of the Atlantic? And I said, yes, but then he went on about TV shows, which is not really what I meant. But he said, with the exception of A Fish Called Wanda, I can't think of many truly great 80s British comedy films. Does Withnell and I count as a comedy? I think Withnell and I does count as a comedy. And probably given a few minutes, I could think of way more 80s British comedy films. Also, it's different because, you know, in Britain, we make kind of one good film every, you know, 15 years. So it's difficult. We don't have the, you know, the four movies every week. So that Hollywood does. We have like the one movie that comes out every 3 or 4 years. So Phil Yeary says 80s has 80s. He says 80s. And then he says Tommy Boy. I liked The Cable Guy, though. I thought Tommy Boy was 90s. Isn't Tommy Boy 90s?
Tommy Boy was 1995.
Right.
And what was the other one he said? Cable Guy
is also 90s.
That's so, 1996.
Yeah, so I don't quite know what he means by that. So Jim DeSantis, who works for Boylan's, which is my favorite brand of soda, he says 90s were the last of virgin comedies. The 80s did these so well. I think it matters on when you grew up. And then Phil says Last American Virgin, and Jim DeSantis says exactly. So he's talking there about like the sex romps, the 80s virgin comedies, the, you know, Revenge of the Nerds, Porky's, those kind of films, I presume. Phil Yeary says Fast Times. David Nowacki says 80s for Planes, Trains and Automobiles and Spaceballs.
Spaceballs was a good one.
Yeah, Spaceballs is a good one. I mean, I'm still more of a Blazing Saddles Young Frankenstein guy, but yeah, Spaceballs is good. Sheena Vanterblack says, oh my god, 80s hands down, John Candy. Someone else says Uncle Buck, to which Sheena says that's her favorite. I think it's funny, I have a really weird thing with John Candy. Always like John Candy. I'm a big, as I said, Who's Harry Crumb fan. I love Planes, Trains and Automobiles and Uncle Buck and a lot of his films, even Delirious and some of the other ones he made. Big fan of his work.
Yeah.
Big fan of Armed and Dangerous and various other John Candy films. And what's interesting is, you know, he passed away and it was very sad and nobody wanted him to pass away and stuff. But it certainly wasn't one that I thought would hit me so much. But every time I've seen him lately on the TV, whether he crops up in an old TV rerun or whether it crops up in a movie, and he did like cameos in, like he's got a cameo in Home Alone that was playing the other day, and he's the guy who helps the mum get back in Home Alone, and that was on our TV the other day. Every time I see John Candy on the TV now, for some reason there's something in me that goes, fuck, we need John Candy. Where the fuck is John Candy? Like, if John Candy was around, things would be okay. Like, I don't know why he's become that guy for me, but he's become that guy for me.
Man dug up John Candy, says it was for a podcast.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, man found hovering around John Candy's grave with a shovel was saying, no, you don't understand. We need him back. Michael D. Stewart says, there are good ones and bad ones in both decades, though my personal preference tends towards 80s comedies. Then Phil and Sheena go on and they're having a conversation about Uncle Buck, which the best bit in Uncle Buck is when he says what did he say? His 5 cents, go down the street and have a rat gnaw that thing off your face, when he's talking to the high school principal. That's probably my favorite bit. Justin Sane says all entertainment in the 90s was worse. And then Kim, and I'm kind of siding with him on that one. Kimberly, my fiance, says 80s because of John Candy, to which Sheena clearly is now her best friend because they're both big John Candy fans. And then Kiva, who writes for the Diner website sometimes, says I like 80s because it gave me gems like Coming to America, Trading Places, Summer School, Summer Rental, Funny Farm, The Money Pit. The list is endless, but it's probably because I was born in the 80s. Going back to my theory that it's often to do when you first, it's like Doctor Who or any of them, like whatever was your formative experience with those things is kind of, I think, where you end up going, I think. So we have a few individual comments as well about the three films we're talking about. So Peter Pedro Osmond says, I always preferred Billy Madison to Happy Gilmore. It depends really on the sort of comedy the film contains. If it's fart jokes and such, then no, they don't hold up because they haven't changed in 20 years. And then what else do we have? Andrew O'Dowd says, same, but it also applies to 80s comedies. Recent viewings of Stripes, Ghostbusters, and Groundhog Day bear this out. Meaning that he rewatched Stripes, Ghostbusters, and Groundhog Day, even though Groundhog Day is the 90s.
1993.
Yeah. He said he watched those movies and they don't stand up for him. He said Stripes. Ooh,
really?
Yeah. He said Stripes and Groundhog Day, he said, I didn't find particularly funny the first time round. Ghostbusters was mildly amusing, the Rick Moranis bits being the highlights. But after seeing it again a few weeks ago, it seemed a bit rubbish. I don't even understand how that's possible. Ghostbusters is like probably top five 80s comedies, if not comedies of all time.
Ghostbusters follows very shortly in one of my favorite movies of all time behind Back to the Future.
Back to the Future is another great one.
Another great 90s. Or 80s, sorry, 80s. 85.
Andrew O'Dowd then says, with regards to 90s comedies, I've never found Adam Sandler remotely funny. People said to me, you just haven't seen the right film. I forced myself to watch quite a few, and without exception, they've all been dire. Austin Powers, the character, is funnier than the movies, which I completely disagree with. I think the movies are funnier than that character.
It's the exact opposite.
He also goes on about being a Carry On fan. I don't know, are you aware of the Carry On movies that were made in England in like the 60s and 70s?
Honestly, other than a few Monty Python's, Flying Circus, that kind of stuff, and Doctor Who, I don't really touch British comedy too much.
Yeah, well, Carry-On's are sort of, they were sex romps before 80s sex romps were a thing. They're kind of like, mildly, very mildly titillating with like ugly British people in it.
Perfect.
And slapstick and stuff like that. So I tell you what, I'm going to read out a few more of these at the end, because otherwise people are going to get sick and tired of the sound of my voice. So let's talk a little bit about 80s movies very quickly before we wrap this up. What for you, sir?
I want to roll up my sleeves, because I've been sitting here with like a loaded one on my chest right now, just waiting to like shoot. Because
do it.
I've been sitting here the whole time. I've read it all on Twitter, just waiting, twiddling my thumbs, like the time is coming. And I'm going to tell you that 90s. Beats 80s.
Okay, you have to give me four examples. No,
I give me an example. The list.
Okay. Oh, great. Let's give me the list then. How does 90s beat 80s for you?
Okay, I'm going to just read everything. Granted, some of these bleed from originating in the 80s, such as The Naked Gun. I'm not going to deny Leslie Nielsen's hilarious. But let's go. Home Alone 1990, Home Alone 2, Lost in New York 1992, My Cousin Vizzy 1992, Wayne's World 1992, Groundhog Day 1993, Robin Hood, Men in Tights 1993, Dumb and Dumber 1994, Ace Ventura, Pet Detective 1994, Ace Ventura, One Nature Calls 1995, The Mask 1994, Nate the Naked Gun 33.5 1994, Clerks 1994, Billy Madison 1995, Tommy Boy 1995, The Cable Guy 1996, Happy Gilmore 1996, Austin Powers 97 and 99, depending on which one you watch, Liar Liar 97, Men in Black 97, personal favorite, Orgasmo. Have you ever seen that?
Yeah, I have. Yeah.
Love that movie, 97. Big Lebowski, 98. There's Something About Mary, 98. Rush Hour, 98. Half-Baked, 98. Waterboy, 98. Wedding Singer, 98. Office Space, personal classic, 1999. American Pie, 1999. And if you really want to wrap it in, South Park, Bigger, Longer, and Uncut, 1999.
So out of that list, from my personal opinion, the only ones that you listed that I would even consider in terms of like comedies that will long outlast the decade that they were made in would be Clerks, The Big Lebowski, and Office Space. Those three, I would say, are genuinely funny classic films. I think that a lot of the other list comes down to complete personal opinion, and I totally get it. And
there That's fair.
And there was certainly, you know, from the years you were rattling off and stuff like that, there are certainly movies in the night. There are certainly a lot of comedy movies that came out in the 90s. It was certainly a decade in which there was a lot of heavy hitters at the time in comedy. It's sort of the premise that I kind of based the episode on was the fact that it certainly was the decade of like the big studio comedy. A lot of the ones you mentioned weren't necessarily unknown to people. They were sort of
big, they were the main
studio,
ones.
Big mainstream studio films. And like we said a little bit at the beginning, and you know, we don't really have time to delve too deep into it, but like there were the Clerks, the Chasing Amy's, the Dazed and Confused, you know, Linklater, Kevin Smith, a little bit in Tarantino's films, a little bit in the Coen brothers films. Like there was comedies in the 90s. And it's not that there weren't great, because Office Space, hands down, that is a fantastic film, should last a long time. The Big Lebowski, one of my favorites, endlessly watchable, endlessly funny.
I think American Pie goes on that as well, because, I mean, not the rest of the franchise. Everything else is terrible, but the first one was amazing.
And I think, again, that has a lot to do with my friend Mo, who is a huge 80s sex romp fan, is now, like, screaming in anger because the American Pie series, because they borrow so heavily and they're so based on those their 80s counterparts, he cannot abide them, cannot stand
them. that's like saying you don't watch How I Met Your Mother because it plays so hard off of Friends, that kind of thing,
right? I don't watch How I Watch Your Mother because I
fair, it's fair enough.
My thing. But I know what you mean. And look, there are certain times to say that. I think that it is, of course, all subjective, and it does all, I think, come down to kind of, like I say, when those films hit you in the sweet spot. But American Pie for me would not be on that like upper echelon for me personally, just because I think there are far better ones from the 80s that do a similar thing, if not a better thing, in a more sort of raunchy, weird, fun, mad way.
I mean, I would put Airplane above it, don't get me wrong, but I'm just saying that was the list that I looked at.
Yeah,
this list also can be found if you Google 90s best comedies. It is not because I stole from that list, it's actually a compiled list,
right? But I mean,
have to defend myself on this,
of course. No, I understand. But then, you know, I would argue in terms of quality over quantity, but I would say in the 80s you get quality and quantity, and I would say that you get far better mileage and far more classic films. I think it's more about the films we'll all be watching in 50 years. Will they come from, like, in terms of comedies, will they come from the 80s or will they come from the 90s? And I think the films, like, whether it's the Vacation movies, whether it's the Fletch movies, whether it's the Three Amigos, Good Morning Vietnam, The Breakfast Club, Princess Bride, Who's Harry Crumb, Uncle Buck, See No Evil, Hear No Evil, The Burbs, Bill and Ted, Back to the Future, Caddyshack, Naked Gun, the original, Midnight Run, The Great Outdoors, Coming to America, Big, Beetlejuice, like, you name it. Those movies are going to be around for decades and decades and decades. Like they are entrenched favorites.
One that slides by every now and then, I know it's a big name, but it slides by, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, 1988.
Right, another classic that I think is going to be around a lot longer in terms of people's rewatchability and in terms of people's conversation about film and stuff like that. Now, there is another argument to say that, you know, maybe in 10 years time, when we're 10 years further away from the 90s films, that some sort of nostalgia, you know, because as I said, like, if you were a kid in the 80s and you saw a lot of these things for the first time, Gremlins or whatever it was, like you saw that stuff for the first time when it came out, that's going to stick with you. But if you were a kid in the 90s, that then a lot of the stuff you saw. So maybe when those guys sort of 10 years from now, maybe suddenly there'll be a big wave of 90s nostalgia. I don't know. But I still claim that in terms of the franchises the 80s started, the one-offs that the 80s started, the actors in the 80s, the films in the 80s, I still say that there are more classics, that they are genuinely funnier, and that they will live long past their decade, more so than 90s comedies, and even and certainly more so than 70s comedies. I mean, there's a lot of great comedies in like the 60s and 70s, but not one of them, I think, has lasted in the way that something like a Ghostbusters will, or a Caddyshack will, or an Airplane will. Like, I think that the 80s was a sort of golden age of comedy, and I think it also has a lot to do with what we were talking about a bit at the beginning as well, with the whole PG-13, which, you know, most families allowed their children from a very early age to watch a PG or a PG-13 film, as they were called over here, and yet they really pushed the envelope. Like you say, like, I saw stuff when I was 8 and 9 that you would never get away with showing an 8 and 9. You know, an 8 and 9 year old these days is still watching Pixar films. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's not a big attack on Pixar. Pixar totally, in the way that the Muppets.
Oh, I still watch it.
Of course, no, in the way that I always say it like this, in the way that the Muppets were in the 80s, in other words, they were for kids, but they had a lot of adult humor and a lot of adult character and a lot of charm and all the rest of it, and an adult message. I think Pixar films are to like the millennium. I think that's definitely the way I look at them, and I love the Muppets, and I'm a big fan of a lot of the Pixar films. But I just mean, in terms of what eight and nine-year-olds are watching these days, they're not even watching Adam Sandler movies, you know what I mean? Like, they're still very infantilized in terms of like what they go and watch. They're either watching like the big budget action adventure Star Wars or Lord of the Rings or whatever. I don't even know if people take kids to Lord of the Rings. Maybe they do, I don't know. But they're either watching those big films, but they're not seeing the content that we saw when we were like 8 or 9 and watching movies that now would be an R, if not an NC-17, you know.
Agreed. And even though, I mean, I'm going to side with the 90s, I already voiced that, but whenever you look at the 80s and the 90s, realistically, I do think, in an unbiased opinion, there's going to be both. It's going to be both. It's like the Jets and the Sharks kind of fighting at it. They're both the same thing, kind of whenever it verges together, that there's gems in both, and if you just sift out the rest of the stuff, a lot of these are going to carry on. Like, I mean, Ghostbusters and Back to the Future clearly have carried on.
Yeah.
But you also see, like, Men in Black, that has carried on more than people think it has. Office Space carries on. I would put in Wayne's World and Groundhog Day, too, but that's just me. But, I mean, like, both sides of the coin have good stuff. The 80s were phenomenal. The 90s were great. It's just all, to be honest, lumped together. It's good. Like, there's no – think of it this way. Turn on TV, you go to comedies. These are just blended together. You don't look, oh, fucking 90s, skip. You're going to watch all of it.
Yeah, and there is certainly, like, the golden age doesn't end. Like, it's not like 89 happens, ends, and then, like, everything after it is crap.
It's like whiskey. It's like, 87, yeah. what a year.
Right, but I do, but I still make the claim. And again, all due to personal opinion and personal experience, but like, I still make the claim that, you know, in the future, it'll be the 80s comedies that people will go back to time and time again. But again, that might just be my generation. Like, I might go, I don't know, but I could walk up to a 20-year-old on the street right now and say who was in Ghostbusters, and they might not even know. So I mean, I'm not in touch with, you know, what an 18-year-old is watching in 2017, so I don't know.
I'm from the 90s, and I don't even think I know. Like, whatever they're watching, I have no idea what's hip with the kids anymore.
Right, and I think if all you've grown up with is, you know, Lord of the Rings and Marvel movies and Star Wars movies, I'm not even sure what your sense of humor is, you know?
Not a bad choice on those, really not bad.
No, but they're good movies, but it's not necessarily been a rich vein of comedy. Like, I still, like, one of the last to me, one of the last, like, really, truly great comedies was Anchorman. Like, that was sort of the last, like, truly great one. There's been some other good ones that have come out since, of course, from the Will Ferrell and crowd. But, like, they haven't got any better than Anchorman in terms of those, like, post-SNL people. You know, Jason Sudeikis and those guys who came out of SNL afterwards have not done anything. I think that some of the Wes Anderson stuff with, like, Life Aquatic and Rushmore with Bill Murray in is very funny, but it's kind of very dry, weird comedy. It's not for the masses. And a lot of the comedy that's coming out is just like, hey, we're a bunch of dudes and we're going to get drunk and fall over. Or, hey, we're a bunch of women and we're going to get drunk and fall over. Like, there's no, I don't know, there's not, some of the funniest things we've seen in movies in the last 10 years have been in Marvel movies because of Robert Downey Jr. or because of, the joke in Avengers with Thor and the Hulk or whatever. Like, they're the jokes we're seeing, and we're not kind of seeing these comedies made for the sake of being comedies in the same way anymore, I don't think.
Like, I'm gonna add off of that. I'm gonna branch off of that. The Marvel movies, I'm a huge Marvel fan, die hard, but it is, the comedy is just lighthearted. It's for the offset. It's not supposed to be funny. It's just supposed to be like, oh, this is such a serious moment, let's ease it up a little bit because no one wants to be too serious. But then flashback to probably one of my favorite things in the world is the scene in The Naked Gun when they're walking to the next room and Leslie Nielsen walks off the set around the wall into the next room and no one says a thing about it.
Yeah.
I thought that was just so clever, so funny. I was dying when I was watching it. And just that dry sense of humor doesn't seem to be very prominent in what comes out today.
Yeah. It's comedy these days doesn't know kind of what it's doing. And I think it's, a lot of it is to do with the fact that the studios just aren't making, like, $20 million pictures anymore, or even $10 million pictures anymore. They're making $300 million movies or, like, $1 million movies. There isn't that market for the kind of mid-budget. Like, most comedies are mid-budget, you know? So that those movies just aren't really being made in the same way that they were before. They used to be the studio's bread and butter. Like, all the stuff you listed off in the 90s, And the stuff I talked about in the 80s, that they were all huge earners for the studio. Because they're made for a moderate budget, and they normally at least double that in returns, if not triple it in some cases. Whereas now, you know, we have a situation where because they've spent $500 million on making and marketing the movie, they've got to make $1 billion back or it isn't really worth it, you know, which is kind of insane to me. I don't even know how that's a business model, but
yeah,
it is what it is. So just to wrap up then, let us have a few more. I'm just trying to sort of scroll very quickly through these comments, and I'm going to pick out a few that I think are worth reading out, but I'm not going to read everything out because we have to wrap it up. But very quickly, Rolly Hatch says, I used to love Ace Ventura, but I haven't watched it in a long time. Transphobia is obviously a big part of the humor in the final scenes, and it's probably hard, impossible to separate or look past that now. We talked about that a lot earlier. He also said, of course, there's plenty of problematic garbage in the 80s comedies too, like Police Academy and Revenge of the Nerds. I guess in comedy, it's always just tempting to punch down for the easy laugh, but as time goes on, it becomes less acceptable and writers have to try harder, which is a good thing despite what it does to the things that we once enjoyed. I'm not sure that Police Academy is problematic. I love Police Academy.
That's actually, no, I do. I know exactly that one comment, exactly to a T, is what I was thinking. It's like Police Academy is great, but there's some parts in it where it is problematic. I do see issues in it. And
yeah, especially when they dress Hightower up as a woman. That's probably the most problematic thing, I would imagine.
Well, whenever they send him to the gay bar and told him the party was there, and they go in and have to slow dance with the guys, and then they come back, he's like, well, did you stop the party? No party, nothing, and just sat down, didn't say a word.
Right, but in that one, the joke is on them. The joke is not on the gay guys. The gay guys are portrayed
I wasn't sure what you were going for on that, so...
Oh, yeah, no. I just mean, like, in Ace Ventura, the joke is on the fact that she's
a guy. They made out with a guy. Yeah,
they made out with a guy. But the joke in Police Academy is that you take these very uptight, very, you know, tightly wound people and put them in a situation that made them feel like abundantly uncomfortable. And then we're laughing at them for feeling uncomfortable. I don't think there's an insinuation necessarily that they were like raped or anything. I think the insinuation is that they had to dance with some guys in a gay nightclub, and that made them feel uncomfortable. And everyone's laughing not at the fact that the people are gay, but laughing at the fact that they were made uncomfortable by the fact. So while yes, stereotypical guys wearing leather caps in a gay bar called the Blue Oyster or whatever might be a cliche, I don't think they're laughing at the fact that they're gay.
Well, it's like the Ace Ventura, you laugh at the fact that they made out with a guy kind of thing. Like the same reason you're making fun of like they're slow dancing with a guy.
Yeah.
I see both sides of it. Don't get me wrong. Yeah.
Dean Garman said, I watched Ace with the Kids the other week and found it mildly amusing, but nothing like back in the day. Also watched Beverly Hills Ninja with the kids, and we all loved it. Have you seen that with Chris Farley, Beverly Hills Ninja?
I think I've seen it a long time ago, but that's something that I have to track back on.
He also says, watched Billy Madison and turned it off after about 30 minutes and absolutely loved it when it first came out. As for Ghostbusters, watched that the other day before last. Never gets old. Still love Stripes and Groundhog Day, as I always have done. Andrew Buckley says, I watched all these again recently and they really don't hold up. They just seem stupid. Yet Ace Ventura was one of my favorite movies for years. However, when I watch comedies from the 80s like Airplane, Caddyshack, Bill and Ted, Beetlejuice, Beverly Hills Cop, Gremlins, Revenge of the Nerds, Weird Science, etc., they still hold up. I think comedies of the 90s went after the low-hanging fruit. It wasn't smart comedy. It was stupid comedy that made us laugh. The best jokes are those that are well-constructed because they hold up. Watching Austin Powers pee when he gets defrosted is funny at first, second, and maybe third time, but then it's not funny anymore. Bill Murray reciting his Dalai Lama bit in Caddyshack is hilarious every damn time. I wouldn't necessarily go that harsh on 90s comedies, but he's definitely probably more in my ballpark, I guess. But anyone who wants to read or see any more of these comments, as there are a lot, and I thank everyone who responded. We love feedback on the show, so it seemed to be a conversation that sparked huge opinions and huge conversations all around the place. Do check out our Facebook group, which is over at facebook.com/groups/AfterMovieDiner. So do check that out over there. So we didn't just get feedback on Twitter and Facebook. We also got an email at our email address, hello@AfterMovieDiner.com. That's hello@AfterMovieDiner.com. Or AfterMovieDiner@gmail.com if you prefer. And it was from Juice Kelly, or Justin Juice Kelly from Juice in the Morning podcast. And he writes, both of these movies I've seen probably over 100 times, referring to Ace Ventura and Happy Gilmore. They have some of the best quotable lines of all time, and anyone who disagrees didn't enjoy the 90s. These movies of the 90s formed a lot of what I looked for in a comedy. I'm also of the unpopular opinion that Ace Ventura 2 was better than the original as well. Keep doing what you're doing, and alrighty then. And that was from Justin Juice Kelly of Juice in the Morning podcast. Check out that show on iTunes and all the places where podcasts are found. Alex, do you have any final words to say, sir, on any of the subjects that we have brought up before we wrap this episode up?
Still going to say Austin Powers International Man of Mystery was a horrible movie. But other than that, thanks again for having me. It was actually a total joy to be able to sit down and talk movies for a little bit. And especially, I mean, it was fun doing the prep for this, like sitting down and watching these movies again. Granted, some of these didn't hit me when how they used to.
Right.
It was still a good time to sit down and watch and really, I mean, really evaluate the acting, the actual setting, instead of just taking it for granted.
Yeah, well, I had an absolutely great conversation. I'm really glad you came on the show. I hope you will come back on the show, and I hope that others from our podcast group on Twitter come on the show. Thanks very much. It was awesome. Please tell everyone again where they can find the Boondoggle podcast.
All right, once again, you can find it on Sprecher, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, iHeartRadio, and even Cornucopia Radio. So pretty much just float around and just type it in. I mean, it's not really a very commonly used word. So Actually, I think it was a movie back in the 80s, Boondoggle. I think it was.
I'm gonna try.
Or was it
now.
70s, 60s? Ah, now you got me trying to Google search it. Let's just type in the word. Do-do-do.
I have not seen it come. I've not seen a movie come up. Let's see. Boondoggle. Boondoggle was a movie in 1999.
Yep, that's the one. Never saw it, never heard of it. Shows how much they actually held up.
Right, exactly. See?
Kind of like the podcast.
another 90s movie that has done nothing for anybody. Anyway, with that, man, thanks ever so much for being on the show. All the very best in your podcasting endeavors, and take care. Have a good night.
Yep, thanks again. Thanks for having me.
Oh, did he go? Oh, yeah. Here we go. Hey, it doesn't get much better than this. Waking up in Minneapolis. I know, my darling, it don't get no better than this. Waking up in Minneapolis. Waking up in Minneapolis. It was here that I had my first kiss. A moment in everybody's life that they just don't want to miss. A bit like waking up with you in Minneapolis. Oh yeah, yeah. A bit like waking up with you in Minneapolis. A bit like waking up with you. A bit like waking up with you in Minneapolis. And it's beautiful in the morning. And it's quiet all right at night. And I love to see you yawning. As through the window comes first light. As through the window comes first light. Down here the heat pipes, they just hiss. Here in Minneapolis, it don't get much better than this. Down here in Minneapolis, I would be remiss if I didn't sing about a Minneapolis. It was here that I had my first kiss. Yeah, 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 yeah. That's the kind of life event you just don't wanna miss. Ooh, Minneapolis blues. Yeah. That showed him.